This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for conversation with an acclaimed jazz singer, a riotous new play extravaganza, or a photo exhibit examining our relationship with water. It's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. Karen Allison is one of the most acclaimed jazz singers performing today. She's also a generous and enthusiastic supporter of New Orleans and WWNO. In early 2006, just months after Katrina, Karen Allison came to the Crescent City to put on a very successful benefit concert for WWNO at Snug Harbor. She'll be back at the Frenchman Street Jazz Bistro under much more normal circumstances for a pair of shows this Saturday night. WWNO's Fred Kasten has this profile of Karen Allison.
Karen Allison was born in Kansas, grew up in Omaha, Nebraska, in a very musical home.
My mom is a beautiful pianist, and she was classically trained, and as were her parents. And my mom was our first teacher. I have two sisters, and she taught us, all three of us, at the very beginning, because she was also a teacher as well as a performer. And yeah, so we started around 5 or 6 years old, and I kept going.
Right. So there was always, I guess, a piano in your house.
Then. Oh yes.
Do you have any memories of kind of messing around with that before you even started lessons?
You know, that's a good question. I guess I must have, but I loved. In fact, that's a great way to put it. I loved to mess around, and I was never a real voracious reader, sight reader, and I think that kind of is what instigated originally my ear, for one thing, because I was a bit lazy about sight reading and I found it very difficult, so I would use my ear more. And I think that's really what really lent itself to more improvisation later.
Singing started for Karen Allison first in church, then learning songs she heard on the radio.
Singer rock songwriter stuff, Carole King, Carly Simon, Joni Mitchell, James Taylor, Simon and Garfunkel, Joan Baez, Roberta Flack, and then further on, when I got a little older, into soul music, Aretha Franklin and, Sam Cooke and all these folks. That was the stuff I was listening to on the radio, and then I'd go out and get the sheet music, which is what they had then. I guess they still do to a certain extent, but in music, actual music stores, and bring it home and sing along and play with the little guitar chord changes that were above,
right.
So that's kind of how that sort of thing started for me.
Did you have bands at any time to play that kind of material, the pop stuff off the radio?
Yeah, I did. First of all, I did it as a solo thing, me playing and singing that stuff by myself. And I'd go into little jam sessions before I was old enough to get into these places, and The one I remember in particular was how I got my first job, my first professional music job. And I had done some musical theater and things like that before, but this was, as a paying gig. So this gentleman heard me, and he said, I played like 2 or 3 songs at this little jam session. He said, "Do you want to come and play in my restaurant?" I said, "Well, I know about 6 songs." And he said, "Well, just stretch them out." So that's exactly what I did. I played... that was my first sort of band as a solo act, and played in this restaurant for 3 to 4 hours, and that's what I did. I played songs that I knew, I learned a lot, and also I stuck in my little classical numbers or little folk numbers. And then when I got into college, that's when I started my own band, jazz, actually. And so we had a combo, and then there was no holding me back. I was in all kinds of bands. I was in an all-girls rock and roll band, I was in wedding bands, I was in funk bands, I was a singer in the big band in college, so it was kind of snowballed.
It was, in fact, fellow students at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, who began to hip Karen Allison to great jazz.
Thelonious Monk, Bill Evans, Ella, Louis Armstrong, of course.
Right. So you got to hear really good stuff.
Yes.
And try to learn how to, you're starting to try to learn how to play these things as you're hearing them, I guess.
Yes, indeed, because, for example, you know, Nancy Wilson's, the Cannonball Nancy Wilson,
right.
Wonderful, seminal, I believe, project was one that thing that somebody turned me on to, and the first time I heard something like, you know, never, never will I marry, anything like that, I would say, whoa, I love that, because it told a story which was rather akin to my folk and pop, you know, world. But there was all kinds of improvisation involved, of course, and this time and this groove and this personality I felt that came out, it was just, you know, wonderful.
Never, never will I marry. Never, never will I wed. Born to wander solitary, wide my world, narrow my bed. Never, never, never will I marry. Born to wander till I'm dead.
The act of telling that story with your band and trying to relate that to the listener, either live or on recording, which are very different experiences, but and then the listeners sending that back to you somehow, getting the realization back, and then that ah moment, you know, where, yeah, I've been through that, and yes, I'd like to do that, or isn't that something, or, you know, just, it's storytelling is something else. Both my folks were storytellers in their own ways. My dad was a preacher and an actor, actually, when he was younger, and loved to read, and my mom in her, you know, many, many ways of telling stories.
Robert Frost did write in settings beautiful and rustic. He wrote of rolling hills and green terrain.
After graduating from the University of Nebraska, Omaha, with a degree in piano performance, Allison moved to Minneapolis for 3 years, where she began to lead her own bands, then landed in Kansas City, initially based at her uncle's club, the Phoenix. In Kansas City, she met a lot of great players, including her life and musical partner, conductor and classical radio personality Bill McLaughlin, and self-produced her first recording, which a fan bought and sent to West Coast jazz DJ Stan Dunn,
who was the West Coast radio promoter for Concord Records at the time, happened to be, but he also was with K-Jazz in the Bay Area at the time. He had a radio show from about 6 in the morning till 11 in the morning every weekday. So people are stuck in traffic in their cars, and he would play music. And I was one of the ones he ended up playing. And so I would start getting these calls from, because I put the Kansas City studio number on it. There was no other way I could do it. I didn't really want to put my phone number on it. So
Right. That's
how they did it. And so the studio would call me occasionally saying, you know, people are calling about this record. And I finally called Stan to thank him for playing our music. And then one thing led to another. He said, I get all kinds of comments about this recording. I'd like to play it for Carl Jefferson, who is the founder and president of Concord Records. And so he did. And then I called Jeff, and that's what we called Jeff, Carl Jefferson. And that's when my record contract began with Concord Records.
13 critically acclaimed CDs and 4 Grammy nominations later, Karen Allison and Bill McLaughlin live in New York City and are integral parts of the music scene there. Her latest recording, the highly praised Yuletide Hideaway, came out in November, and she'll have another independently produced CD, this one of all original material, out later this year. For 89.9 WWNO, I'm Fred Kasten.
J'ai a de luz, festa de sol, e o barquinho a deslizar no macio azul do mar. Tudo é verão e o amor se faz num barquinho pela mar que desliza sem parar. Sem intenção, nossa canção vai saindo de cima e eu sou. Vejar barco e luz, dias tão azuis.
Karen Allison and her quartet play Snug Harbor, 626 Frenchman Street, this Saturday night with shows at 8 and 10. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. Are you a theater fan? Specifically, a fan of new plays. Well, listen up. As Southern Rep, in partnership with the Tennessee Williams Literary Festival, gear up for the new play Bacchanal this weekend. Joining me to talk about the festivities is Southern Rep's Amy Hayes. Welcome to Inside the Arts.
Hi, Diane. It's great to be here.
There are so many events going on within this celebration of new plays. Let's begin with the Play Slam.
Yeah, absolutely. This is from our 6x6 playwrights that Southern Rep has put together. This is a group of about 40 playwrights that write every month on a themed subject, and about 8 of them got together to write something for the new play Bacchanal. It's called Splitting the Neutral Ground, and it's a devised piece that they came up with as a group, so it's going to be exciting, interesting, and who knows what will happen.
Splitting the Neutral Ground?
Yes.
What's it about?
It's about a mixed assortment of characters who are from New Orleans, sort of, I guess, having an issue about this neutral ground, which I think we can all understand.
A neutral ground that's not so neutral.
That's right.
And you have a staged reading of a Ruby Prize finalist, Kimber Lee. First, let's talk about the Ruby Prize. What is it?
The Ruby Prize is a $10,000 award to a female playwright of color. There's not any specific award like this in the United States, so this was really a need. And it was named for Ruby Bridges, who, you know, is an incredible figure in our history who's overcome really difficult obstacles.
And the civil rights activist?
That's correct. And in honor of that, that's why we wanted to honor these playwrights. And we receive about 135 submissions every year, and we choose 3 finalists, 2 finalists, and 1 who is a winner. Kimberly is the winner. She will also receive a reading in New York City, and as well as a week-long writing retreat at Hedgebrook, which is this beautiful place in the Northwest.
So what is Kimberly's play?
Her play is Brownsville, B-side for Trey, that is just a beautiful story about a family really struggling through humor and music to kind of come together.
Now, there's also the Grand Dames of New Orleans.
Yes, local mystery writer Greg Herron's Dead Housewives of New Orleans was the inspiration for the Grand Dames of New Orleans, which we wanted to riff off of and have a lot of fun with. I think New Orleans has so many fabulous characters, and these women are very much sort of fun stereotypes of the women who sort of maybe are here in New Orleans. And it's all sorts of intrigue and infighting and humor with a moderator. It's sort of set up like one of those recap reality shows where they talk about the season that just happened. So you kind of relive the drama and the fighting and the laughter and all of that stuff.
Who are some of the grand dames that we'll see?
Oh, my goodness. We have some of the most fabulous ladies here. We have Nell Nolan, Peggy Scott Laborde, Trixie Minx, Janet Daly Duval, Francine Siegel. We're going to have David Hoover and Margarita Bergen. So watch out.
Now, you are also partnering with the Tennessee Williams Literary Festival for this new play, Bacchanal. What are we going to see from the Tennessee Williams folks?
Partnering together just made so much sense. We've done so many sort of related projects with each other during the festival every spring that we wanted to take it a step further. Our audiences really are kind of simpatico, and we thought that the future of American playwriting is kind of what Southern Rep, our mission, is about. And Tennessee Williams Festival is also about celebrating that and also the legacy of American playwriting via Tennessee Williams. So it just makes sense to say, hey, New Orleans, this is the past, the present, and the future. Come check it out. And in honor of the Tennessee Williams connection for us, we're going to do 5x10, which is going to be an assortment of readings from some plays that you know, Night of the Iguana, which is being produced by Southern Rep this spring, and plays that were just seen recently by audiences, including The Mutilated, which is an early Tennessee Williams piece, and Not About Nightingales, which is also a piece that was recently resurrected. And then we're going to have this fabulous connection between Brenda Curran, who is a wonderful actress who's just moved to town, who's going to be performing a piece from Orpheus Descending. And we're also going to have a scene from Battle of Angels, which is the first version of Orpheus Descending that Tennessee did. So the audience will be able to see like how Tennessee's wonderful imagination took him from point A to the finished product. So it should be a really enlivening, exciting evening.
Now, in addition to all of these activities, you also have panel discussions.
If you are an aspiring playwright or writer, author, poet, you should definitely come to the masterclass discussion on Friday the 10th at 2 p.m. Our Ruby Playwright winners have really interesting perspectives about where they are in their career, how to generate a career as a playwright and a writer, and how they work, what's their process. The other panel is the annual State of the Theater Forum. And since we have these sort of exciting folks in from Chicago, New York, and San Francisco, we want to kind of compare and contrast our theater ecology in New Orleans, which is changing so much right now, with their theater ecologies, and find out what could New Orleans do better? What could we do without? Where are we headed? And what's the priority for the theater community in this city?
And you round out with a toga party?
That's just so I can wear a toga and run around and dance. It's, you know, I think what's so wonderful about writing, about writers and the culture, the literary culture of the world, you know, I always think back to the Greeks. And this is where the Bacchanal started. We wanted to celebrate a festival of words. And so in a nod to that, and also kind of, I think, a New Orleans nod to the joie de vivre that we have as a culture and community, what better way to round out a very serious, exciting festival than with something as ridiculous as a toga? You can just wear it over the top of your fancy outfit, and we will have togas at the door that you can purchase for a very, very minimal fee.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
It is. It's a great weekend of energy and spirit. The toga party is at the Shadowbox Theater, which is on St. Claude at 2400 St. Claude Avenue, and that's at 10 p.m. on Saturday night.
Amy, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you, Diane.
Amy Hayes, Artistic Director with Southern Rep Theater. The new play Bacchanal takes place at the Marigny Opera House, 725 St. Ferdinand Street, Friday and Saturday. More info at southernrep.com. Renowned photographer Edward Bertinsky examines man's relationship with a vital natural resource in his latest work, Water. A series of large-format color photographs on view at the New Orleans Museum of Art and the Contemporary Art Center. And joining me in the studio, NOMA's curator of photographs, Russell Lord. Welcome to Inside the Arts.
Thank you, Diane.
Tell me about Water and the photographer, the internationally acclaimed Edward Bertinsky.
Edward Bertinsky is a Canadian photographer and artist, really, based in Toronto. He has been working for about 30 years in the field and has produced a number of books and a number of exhibitions that have traveled around the world, including the China oil and a series on rock quarries. He really is an interesting figure because he hovers between the worlds of fine art and kind of classic photography. His pictures are in many ways documentary images, but especially with this new body of work, they border on the edge of complete abstraction. So many contemporary art dealers have really responded to these pictures. And I think that they, in the end, kind of hover between the worlds of painting and photography.
Now, I understand that the pictures were taken all over the world, and New Orleans has a big presence.
That's correct. This survey, which is 5 years in the making, includes pictures from China, India, Europe, Iceland, Canada, and British Columbia, and all throughout the United States. But what is particularly important for this community is that the exhibition and the book that accompanies it, they begin with pictures of the Gulf of Mexico in the aftermath of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. So it places New Orleans and the Gulf region at the center of this very global story about water's increasingly fragmented life cycle.
The photographs are large scale. Can you talk about that and describe maybe a few of the pictures we'll see?
They are massive. They begin at 48 by 60 inches and go up from there. A few of them are over 10 feet in length. They're all color images, and most of them, almost all of them, were made from an aerial perspective. Bertinsky has traveled around the world and worked with helicopter pilots, plane pilots. He has a pneumatic pole that extends over 50 feet into the air. In some cases, he even made a few photographs with a drone helicopter where he mounted his camera to the drone. So he's really gone above and beyond just to achieve the picture that he wants to make of each particular place. As I said, many of the pictures really border on the edge of complete abstraction. So in many ways, we as viewers have to work really hard to decipher these images as photographs. So many people look at them and think that they are drawings or paintings upon first glance.
The photographs are also quite seductive in their beauty, and we find out that it's something quite different that we're looking at.
Yes, it's true. I think that Edward Bertinsky has certainly a specific story in mind behind these pictures, and he's very ecologically minded. So in many cases, these pictures, which are really beautiful, turn out to be of places where we have shaped the surface of the earth in a very negative way, where there is a kind of imbalance. There's a section on distressed landscapes where there are kind of gouged and scraped riverbeds where we've completely drained the rivers to divert the water to a certain community. So it really addresses how our relationship with water has changed, especially over the past 100 years, and what humans have done to really kind of either attempt to direct or control water as a resource, and what potentially that might mean for our future. So the exhibition really functions as a kind of open-ended question about the past, present, and future of humanity's relationship with this resource. I hope that people will walk away with a kind of better understanding of the global scale of this problem and what potentially our role might be. I also think that the exhibition is not incredibly didactic. Depending on what you bring to the exhibition, you might feel a totally different way about these pictures. It's worth noting that with the oil series, many people looked at those pictures and said, oh, well, this is really terrible what we're doing to the earth. We're really kind of digging in and farming it. And then there were other people in the oil industry who looked at those pictures as records of their achievement. They, you know, thought that they were these incredible icons of what they had built. And there is certainly a kind of bit about human ingenuity in this exhibition, the massive dams, the incredibly maze-like stepwells in India that he's documented. They really do kind of show the lengths that we've gone to farm or direct or control water as a resource.
Yes. NOMA's curator of photographs, Russell Lord. Edward Bertinsky's Water is in final days at NOMA and the CAC through January 19th. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go inside the arts. I'm Diane Mack.